You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
You may not believe this, but there was a time not so long ago when professional football players weren't paid millions of dollars every year. In the 1970s, Pittsburgh Steelers running back Franco Harris made $22,000 a year, and he was a superstar. He hitchhiked to practice. Hall of Fame quarterback Terry Bradshaw sold cars in the offseason, and team doctors were more likely to hand out steroids than diagnose concussions. Kevin Cook gives an account of the decade that saw the NFL become the most popular sport in America in his new book called The Last Headbangers, NFL Football in the Rowdy, Reckless 70s, the Era That Created Modern Sports. It's created by Norton. It's published by Norton, and I'm very pleased that it brings Kevin Cook to our show today. Hello.
Hi, it's very good to be here.
Although your book focuses mostly on the 60s, the 70s is really the 60s into the 70s, isn't it?
It does track that way. Decades so seldom cooperate with us and fall into those nice 10-year increments. But I do think that the essential evolution of the modern NFL happened in this fascinating period, 10 seasons, between the two most famous plays in the game's history, the Immaculate Reception in 1972 and the catch, the throw from Joe Montana to Dwight Clark in 1982, which kind of ushers in a new era, much more recognizable corporate scripted sort of game.
Well, as a long-suffering Jets fan, I was hoping that you would have said it began with the Jets finally ending the dominance of the NFC.
Well, as with so many things that were happening in those days, seeds of fascinating things that came later took place. And those Jets, of course, have Joe Namath, the matinee idol quarterback. And part of work on The Last Headbangers, I'm talking with Don Shula, not only a great coach, but a significant member of the powerful competition committee. And he's very frank about the decisions that were made behind the scenes to change the rules in the 1970s, to evolve more from a game. We got to protect that matinee idol. People who tune in want to see the handsome quarterback, the star of the game. Changes the game completely. The rules really cause the increasing irrelevance of running backs, the enhancement of the quarterback position to the point that a lot of the guys who played in the 70s don't really consider today's quarterbacks to be football players.
And they even did things like changed where the hash marks were located.
Indeed, and those are the kind of things that people tend not to notice, but they do have such important evolutionary effects.
Well, for example, we had Floyd Little on our show not long ago, mm-hmm. and he says one of the reasons it took him so long to be put into the Football Hall of Fame is the hash marks.
Well, those things get changed, and in fact, that was one of the things that the competition committee had in mind. We want to increase the passing room for the offense, move away from the short side. It was meant to increase passing. What it did was increase running, gives running backs more time. That annoys the competition committee. We've got to keep changing the rules. The rules are further changed again and again and again to get more points on the board, to appeal to the casual fan.
Now, how popular was football with Americans at that point? How did it compare with baseball?
Well, it's such a remarkable thing that's happening. As Monday Night Football began, it wasn't even popular enough to get on the main networks in those days, three networks. Pete Rozelle talked the ABC, which was called the Also Broadcasting Company, into putting Monday Night Football on. That had a big effect, but baseball was still the establishment sport. It's easy to forget in a time of corporate NFL football. We think it almost represents corporate sport. In those days, baseball is the corporate establishment sport. Football is long hair and mustaches and rock and roll, and that, I think, really did have a lot to do with its appeal to a whole new generation of fans.
And how was it doing financially?
Well, it was doing all right, but it wasn't a $10 billion business as it is today. And so much of that is television money. And I think the evolution that the NFL consciously tailored itself to be a television game, and all other sports followed suit after that.
Well, I mentioned that Franco Harris was paid $22,000 a year and had to hitchhike to practice. Were baseball players being paid equally low salaries?
They were paid considerably better. They were paid about twice as well in those days. NHL hockey players were paid better than NFL players. NBA players certainly paid better. And over the course of time, during the 1970s, they're going to start catching up.
But I'd imagine the arguments of the owners were, well, we have a lot more players to pay, and we only play once a week. Those other games, they play 5-6 times a week.
That's true, and they weren't thinking of the short careers and the risks that NFL players are taking, that we see the results of those today. Certainly a much bigger roster, and also the NFL owners in those days are thinking about how many tickets are we going to sell in the stadium, and the television money hadn't yet outstripped ticket sales to such a great degree that all the owners really became incredibly wealthy after this period.
How important was the creation of the American Football League in the 1960s to these changes?
I think it exerted a great deal of competitive pressure on the NFL. When that merger comes along in the end of the 60s, you do get a more AFL sort of game, a more crowd-pleasing, pass-happy game that's somewhat similar in many ways to what we see today. That's what fans really like. And it did cause the NFL to adapt, to catch up with the times a bit. And again, that was a conscious decision. Shula and the other members behind the scenes are saying the casual fans doesn't want to see the Packers win 10-7.
You said TV revenue was an important part of the change. How did the NFL teams divide TV revenue?
They were, of course, smart enough to share their revenue, and that was crucial, and that is the reason that we still have a team in Green Bay, Wisconsin. We still have teams in small markets that other sports don't serve, and that was, this was a remarkable period of leadership in the NFL, as well as great play and memorable players and dynasties. The decision to share revenue enabled the NFL to have a unified front in all ways, against its corporate partners, against the players too, and we see its power just increase right up to today.
Where they're engaged in a battle with the referees.
They are. They're nickel and diming.
Despite all of the embarrassment.
It's true. Nickel and diming the referees to show them who's boss.
So how did they get around the antitrust laws?
They were powerful enough to have corporate friends, the Redskins, of course, based in Washington. Ownership had good avenues into the corridors of power and has been all of sports, and goes back, of course, to baseball in the ancient times, have enjoyed a certain antitrust immunity that other games do not have, that other businesses don't have. And I think that's one of the things that protects the NFL and makes it practically invulnerable to change today.
Well, the NFL had a strategy that it employed twice. There was an upstart league in the 40s. They took the best teams and incorporated them into the NFL. And then the American Football League comes along. They take those teams and bring them in to the bigger family. And
they
give a lot more people employment, but at the same time eliminate complaints that they're anti-competitive.
You absorb them and then go on from there. You can take the strongest franchises that come in. It strengthens the entity that goes forward. I do think that one thing that's forgotten in this great growth, this great corporate growth, is the players who built the league, and that's one of the things the Last Headbangers is about, that this is the last generation that didn't have it made for life because they played in the league.
In fact, when we come back, we'll talk about steroid use and concussions and related matters, why you called them the Last Headbangers. Recently it's been suggested that we would see fewer concussions if they returned to the leather helmet.
Oh, it's possible. It's one would have a tough time on the horrible head-to-head collision, and there'd be a price to pay then. But you can make a case for that.
The book we're talking about, Kevin Cook's book, is The Last Headbangers, NFL Football in the Rowdy, Reckless 70s, the era that created modern sports. It's published by Norton. Stay with us. We will be right back. We're back with Kevin Cook, who's written extensively about sports over the years for Sports Illustrated, Playboy, GQ, Men's Journal, Men's Health, Portfolio Details, and other magazines. His book, the one we're discussing, is The Last Headbangers, NFL Football in the Rowdy, Reckless 70s, the era that created modern sports. It is published by Norton. It created modern sports because this is where football started surpassing baseball as the most popular sport in America?
I believe that's true, and also sports moved from the periphery of the rest of life into something much more central, into something that dominates popular culture. I think football in particular, I think people in those days couldn't have imagined that you would televise the NFL draft or the NFL scouting combine and draw more TV viewers than the Masters or the Indy 500. That the television dominance is really, of all sports, is something that grew out of this era as well.
Well, you've called the last headbangers. We still see headbangers today. But are you suggesting that the sport was a bit freer in those days?
Certainly is. It was much more violent, partly due to the rules. It was really the most all-out football, I believe, that that has been played. A vivid image in the book is Phil Villapiano, one of the toughest players, linebacker for the Raiders, who would knock his head into a cement wall before a game to make sure that his helmet had a nice, snug fit. This in the days before you inflated your helmet. He's one of the ones who survived perfectly lucid without seemingly having any bad result from that. Of course, a lot of other players didn't.
Well, the Raiders were notorious, weren't they? People claimed that they were dirty.
They were.
And they played dirty. And then we kept on reading about what they did when, you know, when they weren't playing football, and they always seemed to be getting into trouble.
It's true, and they were they would wind up in bar fights from time to time. This is also, to amaze modern fans, a time that you could go to the hotel after the game and have some beers with the Raiders. Imagine today going into a bar after an NFL game and lifting a beer with the quarterback, who would be happy to put his arm around your shoulder and talk about the big play. It was a much more accessible game, both to fans and to the press. Players spent more time together than they do today, when a lot of players are spending time with their entourages. It was truly a more accessible game, I think.
Now, you write about bounties on players, which was a big news story last year. Was this the normal thing in the 1970s?
It's yet another aspect of the game that had its seeds planted in the 1970s, in the headbangers era, I think. In those days, you make a big play, which might be intercepting a pass or recovering a fumble, or it might also be knocking the other team's quarterback out of the game. After the game, coach might reach into his pocket and give you a $100 bill. That's a nice dinner. Take your buddies out. That grows, as with everything else in the game, booms into unbelievable proportions until it's organized tens of thousands of dollar bounties strictly for injuring players. It perverts something that was started out in the 70s a little more innocent.
So why was New Orleans punished this year for paying defenders to hurt opponents, if this is part of the tradition?
I think it was specifically to injure players. That was the idea in Bounty Gate with New Orleans. And also, there's a big difference between $100, even if it's technically illegal in those days, and an organized program that pays much larger amounts.
You mentioned that the rules were changed to tilt the game to favor the offense. Do you think that's good for football?
I hate to make value judgments on the game. I don't want to be one of those sports writers who thinks that the game was better when he was a kid. It certainly makes it different. It keeps the quarterback on the field. So if you want your team to have his first-string quarterback out on the field, it helps in that way a great deal.
In 1971, Floyd Little became the 13th player to rush for 1,000 yards in a season. The next year, 10 players rushed for 1,000 or more yards. So it was a lot easier to rush?
It was really an unforeseen consequence of that rule change that moved the hash marks toward the middle of the field. If you take a look at the field, they're the exact width of the goalposts. That's different from the game before, different from college football. The idea was to give passers more room on either side of the hash marks to find their receivers. What happened instead was the running backs, who'd been pinned to one side of the field, the short side, now had either side they could go. It's an unforeseen consequence of that rule change, and it led to what was called the year of the runner.
And I'm assuming some teams benefited from that. Were they aware that some teams were going to, based on their personnel?
Not in advance. I think you want the teams that are more popular to do well. You want big market teams to do well. That was not conscious, I don't think, on the part of the competition committee to benefit certain teams. They want the whole product to become more popular than baseball. That was their goal.
Well, in the beginning of the 70s, the Miami Dolphins looked poised to be the team of the decade. Were they?
They could have been. And another historical incident in the headbangers era is the WFL. You refer to the other leagues that came in. This is a challenge to the NFL. Took stars, Jim Kick and Larry Zonka and Paul Warfield, away.
Herschel Walker signed with them.
A lot of good stars that the NFL wanted to have. that was a fascinating moment because a big part of the core of that great Dolphins team goes to another league. It really opens the door for the Pittsburgh Steelers to begin their dynasty in the latter part of the 70s.
And they win four Super Bowls in the 1970s. So they were just so much better than the other top-tier teams?
They were brilliantly coached. They drafted magnificently. They specialized in a lot of overlooked players from traditionally black schools that were scouted more intelligently than by the Steelers than by other teams. They got Bradshaw, and Bradshaw's a fascinating character. People who know him from television think he's an aw shucks kind of character. Much more complicated than that.
But he wasn't the greatest quarterback of his time.
He might have had the greatest arm. He went on to become such a significant factor, I think, because finally he got along with his coach. He needed a coach to put his hand on his back and say, Terry, you're my man. You're my quarterback. Lead this team to the Super Bowl. Chuck Knoll is not that kind of character. This is a man who, when he first won his first Super Bowl, his wife came running up to him and he reached out and shook her hand. So Chuck Knoll is not going to put his hand on your back. So when you ask Bradshaw, what was it that made you a Hall of Fame quarterback? He said, well, when the time the coach finally told me, Terry, you're my quarterback. Well, when was that? And he said, well, he never really said that. I just pretended that he did.
Concussions are an everyday occurrence in football. How did team doctors treat concussions in the 70s?
With a certain sort of blithe disregard in most cases. It was the idea by teams and by players themselves was concussion, when you get dinged, it was very seldom called a concussion. You got dinged, you got blown up, you got your head handed to you. And the next thing you do when you can find the field is to get back on it.
Man
up. As fast as possible. Man up is right. It's a situation that really ruined lives in the long term.
And we would hear coaches sometimes saying, this guy just can't get himself ready for a game. He lets injuries stop him.
That's right.
Players would be criticized for not playing through major injuries.
With nasty, frilly terms applied to them and their manhood questioned in a way that was really designed to get them back out on the field sometimes before they were ready.
I'm not sure all of this is in advance. Then we have the whole matter of steroid use. Didn't the NFL drug test its players?
Not until later, although it was before, in advance of other pro sports. This is a time really before the age of drug testing. One of the most vivid images I had working on Headbangers was of a jar of testosterone, horse testosterone, in a locker room. And you knew that's what it was because it has a picture of a horse on it. And the players are saying, let's have some of that. And what's the dosage? Well, the same as you would give a 1,400-pound horse. So this is something that will certainly get your nostrils flaring on your way to the field.
Were they illegal at the time?
Technically, you need a prescription. It was not the sort of thing that would prevent you from getting your hands on it.
And I remember people talking about how dangerous they were. Almost from the start, the players must have known that.
Well, and it goes all the way back to Olympic programs behind the Iron Curtain. I think players had an inkling, and I think that's one of the tragedies of this time, that they did not know how much they were risking their bodies, their brains, and ultimately their identities. They had an inkling, and that's the sacrifice they made. They played for themselves, they played for money, they played for families, for team, and for love of the game, and they risked a lot.
And weren't football players also using a rudimentary human growth hormone?
Yes, and it's a term that if you're writing a book about sports, you don't expect to encounter the term pooled cadaver brains. But the source of this stuff, this rudimentary HGH, it would scare Dr. Frankenstein.
By the end of the 1970s, players were being paid considerably more than ever before. What led to them getting the money?
Well, it was the brief triumph of the Players Association, led by John Mackey, who had a tragic end not long ago after encountering dementia in his later years. The NFL Players Association did finally beat the owners in court. They promptly bargained a lot of their victory back, and they are today, in many accounts, the weakest of the major sports unions. But it did help get the players more money than they had before then.
Has gambling helped make the game grow? Las Vegas estimates that last Monday night's game between the Packers and the Seahawks cost gamblers an estimated $1 billion. A billion dollars. Well, so lucky, that's a lot of money.
Lucky for some of those bettors, they got their money back from some offshore betting outfits that said, "Well, it wasn't fair. It was such a blown call. We're gonna call that a wash and give you another bet." I think gambling has an enormous amount to do with the growth of the NFL. It drives television viewing, among other things, and makes the game, makes fantasy more popular. It has an enormous amount to do with it.
Well, now the steroids are banned and concussions are taken seriously. But how much has the game changed since the end of the 70s, the catch that you end your book with, and today?
I think it has changed quite a bit. I do think that that 49ers team that was pre-scripted in a way that the great teams of the 70s were not. The game is
great
decided.
Great coach Bill Walsh, a great quarterback Joe Montana.
Certainly. And although Joe Montana pointed out to me, fans forget, he's the first quarterback who had a radio in his helmet. Bradshaw thinks a quarterback ought to call his own game. Well, with the complexity of today's game, that's really impossible. You're getting your calls sent into you by coaches. And the game is decided to a large degree in meetings during the week before the game, all in preparation. The complexity of the game is astonishing today. But I do think that was the beginning of what we can recognize as a corporate, pre-scripted, more modern sort of NFL.
Just one more thing. John Madden is a kind of a hero to sports fans. He was the coach of that Oakland Raiders team that was so out of control.
He was, and he was beloved by those players. He was one of them, you know, long hair himself, the youngest coach in the league. He had one rule, which was be on time and play hard on Sunday. He treated his players like men. He didn't have a dress code on the team trips. They adored him. He did know that modern football gets a little nasty on the corner sometimes, and all he wanted to do, most of all what he wanted to do, was win. But he was widely admired and was really a fabulous coach.
Well, how did he react to the excesses?
He wanted them to stay out of jail, which they did. He believed that other teams bent the rules. You know, the Raiders bent the rules like crazy and sometimes broke them. I think he was for bending them without breaking them, but they all believed that the rest of the league was out to get the Raiders anyway.
There are people who say that every play in a football game could be penalized for holding.
That would be a long game, yes.
But that would be possible, and the Raiders were famous for doing that sort of thing. Kevin Cook's book, The Last Headbangers, NFL Football in the Rowdy, Reckless 70s, the era that created modern sports. It's published by Norton. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks. Pleasure.